Meeting will come back to order. It's 25 minutes to 2 on March 15th. It's a continuation of Senate Finance meeting that we started this morning. While Permanent Fund Department Revenue is coming to the table, recognize back with us Senator Green, Senator Bundy, Senator Olson, and Senator Dyson. Senator Hoffman is traveling and due shortly. Joined again by Senator Stedman, Senator Gary Stevens, and Senator Wagner and Senator Cowdery. Thanks for joining us, men.
We're here to draw.
Oh, and Senator French. Come on over here. Oh, okay. So it didn't like reflect, oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. I know, I can say that, I know how that works. Okay, let's see, is anything come before the committee before we continue our discussions? If not, then let's bring before us Senate Joint Resolution 18. It's sponsored by LBNA by request. Senate Joint Resolution 18 proposes a constitutional amendment that changes the management of the permanent fund. The resolution establishes an annual payout limit of 5% of the total market value of the fund, and that market value will be based on a five-year average. Constitutional amendment proposed would be in front of the voters for November of 2004. We have Mr. Store, Mr. Bartholomew with us, and they're ably assisted by Laura. And it looks like she's getting it fired up. So if there's nothing to come before us, then let's ask Mr. Store to start your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the Senate Finance and members of the Senate as well. I am Bob Store. I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation. And to my right is Bob Bartholomew, our Chief Operating Officer. And Laura Shea is going to help me on the PowerPoint because I'm not particularly skilled at technology, basically. But I'm going to go through the presentation. Bob Bartholomew is going to talk about some of the technical aspects. For many, this is not a new presentation, so forgive me if I'm going too fast or if I get too technical, please stop me and ask questions along the way, if that's okay.
And let me just expand on that a bit. Probably be best to listen to this presentation if there's a, before we start to get into the technical parts of it, if there's a slide or something that you need to have explained a little bit more, then please signify that. If not, if we want to expand on some of the concepts like we did this morning, let's wait till the end and everybody will have their chance to go wherever they want with this. There's a lot of meat here, and we want to make sure we get it all connected before we start to take it apart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And meeting joined by Senator Seekins.
And invariably, I will wander into a technical speak at least once in the presentation, so please call time when I do that and ask me to revisit it. It won't be your fault if you don't understand. It'll be my fault, I assure you. Just the next page just starts out with the permanent fund's charge, which is to, the fund should provide a means of conserving a portion of the state's revenue for mineral resources to benefit all generations of Alaskans. And from the very beginning, from the first chair of the Permanent Fund Board to the first executive director of the Permanent Fund Board, we've espoused inflation proofing or ensuring that the permanent fund's purchasing power meets all generations equally. And our proposed constitutional amendment addresses that issue. A brief history on the fund's value, and you can divide the fund into two components. One is principal, and then the other is the earnings reserve. And the principal really is comprised of three components, and which is contributions from mineral wealth, from inflation proofing, and on many occasions, or several occasions, the legislature has appropriated additional income from the earnings reserve into the principal of the fund. Now, and if you were to break it down, you'd find that about a third of the principal is mineral wealth, a third is inflation proofing, and about a third is special appropriations. This, under, I've been around the fund a long time, this fund, the numbers you see reflect the recent AG's opinion, which has unrealized gains or losses as excluded from the earnings reserve of the fund. If you were to look on June 30, 2000, the number would be more like 20 billion or slightly in north of 19 billion in pure principal, as I defined, which is mineral inflation proofing and special contributions. The balance of $3+ billion is unrealized gains or appreciation. And you can see how the earnings reserve has diminished over time because we went through a rather severe bear market. And a theme I'm going to talk about on the percentage of market value payout or limiting to no more than 5%, appropriation no more than 5% of the fund, how important creating the discipline in the good years is. And that's exemplified, in my opinion, on what you see up there, where while the realized income dropped down considerably over the years, we were able to distribute three dividends and inflation-proof the permanent fund three times during the bear market. Why? Because the legislature displayed the discipline not to overspend in the good years so that we had a cushion for the bad years. If you looked at 6/30/02, inevitably I get asked the question, and there were three times during that year where the value of the fund on a given day actually went below the principal number, and that was because of unrealized losses in the equity market. On the next slide, I want to show how the asset allocation of the permanent fund has changed over time. The current payout methodology is based on realized income, and that's dividends, interest, cash flow from real estate, and any profits the managers may take. Now, you'll see that that made a lot of sense in the late 70s, early 80s, when the permanent fund was invested exclusively in fixed income securities or bonds. What's the characteristic of a bond? Virtually all of the money that you earn is through cash flow and not appreciation of the asset. And so if this was 1978 and I was creating a dividend formula, I would base that dividend formula the same way we are doing it right now. I think it made a lot of sense then. But you can see that over time, the fund has matured, and we look a lot like other funds right now, a little more conservatively structured, but you'll see, I always point out that I arrived in May of 1983, and in June or July of 1983, the permanent fund funded their first equity managers, and you can see the growth first in U.S. equities, real estate, and in the late 80s, we started investing in non-U.S. stocks and then non-U.S. fixed income. That's mostly sovereigns issued by the U.K., Japan, Germany, high-quality debt. And so you can see how the fund, but and the key here is we are no longer structured for a large cash flow by investing over 55% in the fund in equities right now. Most of your return in equities is through appreciation. There's very little cash flow via dividends that comes out of equities. So now we're oriented much in a much greater manner towards appreciating assets rather than assets that are exclusively invested for the cash flow. I do need to touch base on what we're proposing. Hopefully everyone here is familiar with it, but we are proposing what we think is a very important issue, which is to convert the fund to a payout of market value methodology. And we're proposing that in any given year, no more than 5% of the fund's assets may be appropriated. Why do we do that? Because we, for a lot of study, both from historic perspective and prospectively as well, we are comfortable that, the fund's asset allocation and policies can earn a 5% real rate of return. We will earn inflation plus that 5%, and but that is not realized. That is total fund value. Yeah, and what is not stated in here is that it should be over a five-year moving average as well. Why? That smooths out the payout methodology. If you looked at the fund value from year to year, it can change dramatically. But if you use a five-year smoothing, then you then there will be greater predictability and less volatility in the payout if you appropriate that. Now, we've over time, we've distilled it down into a rather simplistic 8% rate of return, 3% inflation, and a 5% real rate of return. And that's true. Over the longer term, we expect to earn that. But the number that we're actually the most comfortable with is our ability to achieve a 5% real rate of return. For example, if you were to look at our asset allocation that we just adopted last week, we project a 5% real rate of return, but we project a 7.6% nominal rate of return. Why? Our consultant believes that inflation over the next 5 years will be more like 2.6%. And so the key, the most important number here, is that 5% real rate of return, recognizing that things, the other numbers can change over time, or in the near term. Longer term, we're more comfortable with that historical inflation rate of 3%. Just to give you a little perspective, right now inflation is running just slightly above 2%. But there's a lot of reasons why we think that'll go up slightly over time. I want to reinforce the 5% real versus the nominal, and I think that the there's a great illustration over the last 10 years from fiscal year 94 to 03. If you think about those 10 years, we experienced great appreciation in the equity market, unsustainable bull market, very high appreciation. But we also experienced one of the more severe down markets in the last 100 years as well. But if you use the whole 10 years, you're going to find out that our returns were essentially normalized, albeit with a more on the upside and then more on the downside in the short term. You will, if you can look at that over that 10 years, the top number, 7.8%, that is the nominal rate of return that the fund earned during that time period. But you'll see inflation during that period was only 2.5%. So in fact, we actually achieved a 5.3% real rate of return. And again, I like this number because it shows the bull market and the bear market that we experienced during that 10-year period. If we look at the next slide, we looked at how achievable is the 5% real rate of return over the over a rolling 10-year period. So every point looks backwards 10 years. So when we add a new year, then we drop off an old year. And if you look at the fund's returns through all time periods over the last, from 94 on, we have achieved a 5% real rate of return or greater. There's a hesitation because we earned over 20% in the calendar year. There's a hesitation to update that and show you the spike upwards. But I think the key here is what I alluded to earlier. It was the discipline that the legislature displayed during the good years by not overspending is what gave us the cushion to meet the down years. If you were to look at 99, and I should explain this, zero is the excess return inflation on this chart, and then the red line, the 5%. is the 5% real rate of return. So we're just trying to chart our excess return over inflation during that period. But the key to me, my mind, is if you go to 99 and 2000 and think about the lack of discipline where you get caught up in overspending, then you would drop down dramatically, and then we would be in a deficit situation right now. Now, if you were to look at five-year rolling averages, you'd find that virtually all time periods, with the exception of the last couple, we still achieve that 5% real rate of return. The worst case scenario, I think we achieved a 1 or a 2% real rate of return during that period. So I've spoken about volatility, and this next slide shows the volatility between the current formula, or the formula we propose, which is a percentage of market value payout, and the volatility in using a realized income rate of return. And this is not what we earned in a year. This is the rate of change in any given year. So we didn't earn, if we take that spike up in 1996, and I'm going to get questions about that later on. I just know it. I just feel it, but we'll talk about it then. But if we did not achieve an 80% rate of return, what we did was that realized income exceeded the year before by over 80%. But you will see if you look at this chart that there is a lot less volatility in using a percentage of market value payout. So what's that mean? That means greater predictability in terms of the income flow. And I will come back to 96 a bit later because I think there will be interest in that. So why do we need the POMV? For the present, it ensures the option of an annual payout. That's an option. One can evaluate, if they're elected official, whether to pay out the whole 5% or not, but it does ensure the option. Makes the payouts more stable from year to year, and it makes the payout compatible with modern investment strategies, or our investment strategies, which says invest in less in income producing assets and more in the higher appreciating assets. For the future, it prevents overspending in the good years, and it maintains the purchasing power of the entire fund by switching to the POMV. By now, we've been asked a lot of questions, and we wanted to address what many of the Alaskans have been asking us. Will this change leave principal unprotected? And the answer is, should not be alarming, but you no longer need the concept of a principal. And so this does remove the word principal, but it actually, over the longer term, ensures the purchasing power of the entire fund. So at the near term, there is, if we're having some very bad years, policymakers can evaluate whether it's more important to appropriate some of the money or not. But you can see by the earlier slides, I think the real issue is that discipline that's created in the good years. Second question we get asked inevitably, and this is always my qualifying statement, where the Board of Trustees and staff feels very strongly about how the fund is protected, but we recognize that how funds are used is the prerogative of the legislature. But everybody asks us, how will it affect our dividend? And the answer is, you don't have to change the dividend formula. We think there's an argument to do it. You don't have to change the dividend formula. If you were in Fairbanks last February, you'd have seen that there was a 10% chance that in any given year, there would be zero dividend under the current dividend formula, but you don't have to. There's a lot of discussion and recognition that changing the dividend formula to a percentage of market value payout consistent with the limitation is a good way to go, and the reasons are greater predictability, less volatility, which helps decision makers, merchants, et cetera, but we get asked that question. I used to, for a while, I started my presentation by saying, what is this not? It's not a rate on the permanent fund. It's a limit on how much can be appropriated. But unfortunately, we hear people saying this is a rate on the permanent fund. And what I say is what everyone in this room knows. We would be talking about POMV if there weren't any fiscal problems. And you would be talking about the fiscal problems if there was no POMV. They are parallel issues. Why fix the permanent fund if it isn't broken? Well, hear that some. And the answer is, in my strong opinion, it is broken. It's been broken for a long time. But if what is since a 15-year bull market masked what is a very archaic payout formula. And so the question that I would ask then is do you want to wait until the permanent fund is identified as broken? Because in my mind, there's a huge cost of waiting to address this issue. And the cost is lost income and dislocations to people that expect the dividend, et cetera. That dividend formula, the payout formula, made a lot of sense in the 70s, but it is really inconsistent with modern portfolio management right now. I've added a piece that's not on here because it's an important issue I hear from time to time, and I believe it came up this morning as well, and it's by investing in equities, are you not double inflation proofing? And I'm going to say it in my simplistic way. I think it's good to hear that answer. People saying the same thing two different ways can help. I'm going to ask Bob Bartholomew to speak. Bob, oh, by the way, by way of introduction, we'll be going through the technical aspects of the legislation as well. The answer is we are not double inflation proofing. There is no question that we are investing in equities that rise over time, and they rise in well in excess of inflation. The issue and the problem becomes that once our manager sells that stock, it gets converted into realized income, and realized income can be and has been distributed. If you change the formula to the POMV, that statement will not be correct. But as long if we're buying GE and it appreciates, and GE is appreciated well in excess of inflation, you've achieved your goal. If our manager decides they like Emerson Electric better than GE, and they sell that GE and they take all the profits, it is now realized income, and realized income is available for distribution. And I'm going to pause there. I'm going to ask Bob to embellish on that a bit more and then go through the technical side of it.
Maybe before we do that, some things that on Bob's presentation that you might want to clarify before we go to Bob Bartholomew, and then we'll get it all on the table, and then we'll come back and talk about specific points. I should, before I go to Senator Bundy, I should just mention for the body that in the back of the room is Roger Cremo. Roger, thanks for joining us today. It's nice to have you with us. Senator Bundy?
Something that Mr. Storer mentioned about you don't have to change how the PFD is calculated, even if you go to POMV, and I'm just wondering, I'm not quite grasping that. Currently, the PFD overly simplified, is a calculation over the earnings of the past five, rolling average of past 5 years. If you go to POMV, would you have earnings? Or, I mean, wouldn't you have to change how the PFD is calculated? What am I not understanding?
To the chair, Senator Bundy, the current dividend formula is based on realized income only. And so I'm just going to stay with that and then I'll comment on it. So the answer is you could go to POMV and still live with the current dividend formula. Where you would become at odds is if the dividend formula, if the dividend calculation becomes greater than the 5%, you'd have that wall. That has not happened very often. Usually, the way I projected is bands, the dividend formula has been between 2.5% and 4% over time, with some in excess of that. So one does not need to change the dividend formula and go to POMV. You have to recognize that once in a while, in a good year, or in a series of good years, you may get a formula. You may get a payout that is in excess of the 5%, and then you hit the firewall. We do believe there's an argument to mirror the payout formula with POMV. We think having formulas that are the same is, in fact, a superior way to go. Right now, the dividend formula conflicts with inflation proofing and the POMV. But
might follow. One of the criticisms that I hear from the public that perhaps doesn't quite understand what you're trying to do.
Everybody get closer to that mic if you would.
I'm sorry. One of the criticisms I hear from people that maybe don't quite understand what you're trying to do is that if we go to POMV, the amount of their dividend over time would go down. So if we maintain the current calculation, but had POMV, the dividend would be relatively volatile, and in some years could spike and be higher. Is that
under the existing formula?
Yeah.
Under the existing formula, you would get greater volatility, and no question about that. You would have some probability of no dividend at all under the existing formula if we hit a severe bear market and we were taking losses. But there would be greater volatility. And I forgot the other point I was going to make on that, so I apologize. Do you have anything to add?
Well, I think what's important...
Identify yourself, please.
I'm Bob Bartholomew, the Chief Operating Officer for the Permanent Fund Corporation. And to the chair, to Senator Bundy's question, if you leave the current formula in place, then obviously the dividends would be the same as they would be if we didn't make any change. Makes sense. And then the risks that Bob Storr were talking to is that they're going to spike. You're going to have high years and down years, potentially zero. So that's what you have today with the dividend formula, and that's what you would have under POMV if you leave it to statutes based on realized income. The challenge to answer the question to how does it affect the dividend is when the legislature makes the next step, which is how are they going to use the earnings, and then you have to define how are you going to use the earnings and how much goes to dividends and how much goes to other. That's where the real issue comes with the public on trying to understand where this is going. So we could leave the formula exactly like it is, and it would just force the permanent fund to take two sets of records. We'd keep the generally accepted accounting principle records that matter, that match POMV, and we would keep a separate set of books to track the old-fashioned way of accounting for realized income. And you can do that, and you'd prefer not to, but that the dividend can be at whatever level you want it to be. It's a decision.
And at the risk of flogging this one too hard, that Bob brought up something that I thought was the one point I wanted to make, which is the bigger the fund, the greater your earnings compound. 10% over 20 billion is smaller than 10% over 25 billion. So anytime you take some incremental income to use for, we'll say, government purposes, you're going to be compounding on a slightly smaller fund. So there would be some probably small diminishment on the value of the dividend, but that exists under the current formula or POMB.
Thank you. Bob, you want to go ahead?
Bob's my technical guy. So.
What I'm just going to walk through is the actual constitutional amendment itself, SJR 18, the State of Affairs version, which should be in your packet, and then on the front of the presentation we just went through is a one-page overview dated March 2004.
Let me interrupt you just for a moment. I didn't ask the visiting senators. Senator Seekins, is something for now or for later? Okay, you need to come over.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just before we get into the amendment, the proposed legislation, a couple of questions. I know you expected someone to ask about that blip in 1996. Yes. Was that a decision that was made by the managers of the fund, or was that made internally?
To the Chair, Senator Seekins, that was a board decision. And our equity exposure, as a bit of history to how they made that decision, was our equity exposure is divided into two parts. One is active management. Our managers are buying and selling securities every day. But there's another component of the fund, which is called passive management or an index fund. At that time, the U.S., the permanent fund did then, and it does now, it invests a considerable sum of money in a passive portfolio designed to replicate the S&P 500 index. There's no market timing whatsoever in it. Remember, I said I arrived in July of 83. Well, that passive manager probably bought GE stock then and never sold all of it because it would take an explicit direction. So what happened in that period is there was a bull market. And I'm told there were discussions at the time about intergenerational equity. And by that, there was a concern that the passive portfolio would grow and grow, and that future generations would benefit well in excess of current generations from that stock market. And so the board, in their decision-making process, determined that they wanted to do some methodology that allowed current generations to benefit from the bull market as well as the future generations. And I come back to the word intergenerational equity. So the board, through that process, that decision, determined that some profits should be taken in that passive portfolio. And that act of realizing that income then actually created a larger dividend than you would normally have received during that period. Does that answer your question?
It does to some extent. So basically then, under the current system, the board could manipulate the amount of money that's taken by deciding or telling fund managers what to sell and when. Am I correct there?
Through Chair Senator Seekins, a future board could take profits, either a well thought out reason or for other reasons.
And I appreciate that answer.
That fact exists.
One of my fears, having been on the board, was, didn't take me long to figure out that the board could basically play God with the dividend based on, they have the authority to tell managers what to sell or when to bring in those profits. So under the PMV system, since we have the availability for the funds profits to be manipulated under the current system, would that exist under the PMV system?
It would, under the PRV, it would exist less so because there's a limit on how much you can take. If you mirrored the payout formula to PRV, then it would not exist at all, which is the other point of PRV. The most important point is inflation proofing. But there's absolutely no question that PRV is a management tool, and it's a positive management tool. Not only you are now making asset allocation decisions based solely on maximizing the return of the fund and no other issue.
And one other question. Under the current system now, I hear people commonly tell me, well, this system doesn't allow any of the principal to be spent, no erosion to the principal. Now, I know you and I have talked about this. But is that the case?
Through the chair, we're now wandering into technical speak here, and so right. I'm not sure the board would agree land on a single spot. What principal is a notational number. It's an accounting number. It simply identifies what I said earlier. Mineral contributions from mineral wealth, inflation proofing, and special appropriations. I'm going to pick on GE today. That GE stock is not three quarters principal and one quarter earnings reserve. How the money is invested is invested completely separately. The Attorney General's opinion is that that what is available for distribution is the realized income for the fund. So consider, if you will, a fund that's $23 billion, and we're in a bear market. So I'll use extremes. The value, the principal is $23 billion. And the value of the fund is $21 billion because stock market went down dramatically. But we have $1 billion in realized income. So $23 billion, $21 billion, $1 billion. That $1 billion is available for distribution, even though the value of the permanent fund is below principal.
Okay. And you know, I know that you've announced your retirement from the fund. You've done a terrific job being a nonpartisan manager of the fund, in my opinion. And I've seen your career from way back in the 90s when I worked with you. But if I were going to give you a hypothetical, I gave you $28 billion, assuming no political ramifications. I gave you $28 billion, and I said, Mr. Storrs, I'm going to give you two options. One's the present way that we manage this fund now for distribution to the people, as Dave will ask, and the other is POMV. And I asked you, I said, I want you to sell the present system to the people of the state of Alaska. How would you do that?
With great difficulty. through the chair. This question's come up, and we've talked about it, and I've thought about it. The POMV. Not only modernizes the payout methodology, but generally accepted accounting principles makes no distinction between realized income and appreciation. You earn everything. Every day we earn some appreciation or we subtract depending on the markets. So I have not figured out an answer on how I would sell the current system, because most endowments and foundations use a percentage of market value payout. The current methodology, there's a huge hurdle, in my opinion, that says you have to argue why generally accepted accounting principles shouldn't apply to the management of the permanent fund. And I think that's a huge hurdle. Probably more than one senator would ask, if we went to the current system, the realized income could be manipulated as well. And so those are huge hurdles, in my opinion, to argue for if we were in a POMV environment.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to just add one comment.
Just hang on just one second. Okay. Senator Bartlett, Senator Stedman, could we get Mr. Bartholomew's testimony on the table, and then we can go back and answer all these technical questions on what he just said, Senator Bundy?
Mine isn't technical. It is a more broad philosophical public policy question, and I'm happy to wait.
Can you hold it for just a little while? Senator Stedman, is that okay if we come back? Okay. Bob, if you would, please. Okay.
Mr. Chairman, so we'll have Senate Joint Resolution 18, the State Affairs version, and then I'm going to walk through the overview just to put on the record what are the exact changes being proposed to the Constitution. In the resolution, we're starting on page 1, line 10. That's the first change. And what basically that change is doing is just saying in the first paragraph of the Constitution, we're going to add a second paragraph to explain the percent of market value. So that's the first change. Then on page 1, line 11, we're removing the word principal from the Constitution. And the effect of that is you no longer will have a principal and an earnings reserve. You would have one permanent fund with a combined pool of money, which is currently how it's invested as one combined pool. The third change would be on lines 13 and 14. Currently, the Constitution directs that all income from the permanent fund will be deposited into the general fund unless otherwise provided by law. And by law, it has been provided by statute that all income will be retained in the permanent fund. But that's a statute that could have been changed at any time. And so by removing lines 13 and 14, that means that by Constitution, all income or earnings of the permanent fund will remain in the permanent fund, not the general fund, and they'll be there until they're appropriated. The fourth change is on page 2 of the resolution. And then lines 2 through 6 is what is being added to the Constitution that, in essence, implements the percent of market value and places a spending limit on what can be taken annually from the permanent fund to no more than 5% of the value of the fund. And that's going to be a 5-year average, just so that, again, you can limit the volatility. But it's a 5% spending limit based on the value of the permanent fund, the total value. And then there is added in there what we call as a look-back provision that tells us to look back one extra year. And the purpose of that is so when the legislature comes into session in January, they'll already know what's available for that upcoming budget year from the permanent fund. There's no projections, no guesses. We would set the formula so that you knew when you came into session what's available. The fifth change is actually just a technical provision that doesn't go into the Constitution. It's called the transitional provision. And that is, there has been some legal questions about whether the existing earnings reserve, which has several billion dollars in it, is actually part of the permanent fund or part of the general fund. And this provision makes it clear that at the time that this amendment takes effect, all of the earnings reserve will go into the permanent fund, subject to the 5% spending limitation. And then the final portion is Section 4 of the resolution, and that's the requirement that if this is adopted by the legislature, then it would go before the public at the next general election, which is November 2004. So that, Mr. Chairman, is the proposed constitutional amendment that the Board of Trustees has recommended.
Okay, Senator Bundy, and then Senator Sedna, and we have been joined by Senator Getz. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Backing up a little bit on the philosophical view here, certainly not all Alaskans were here when the permanent fund was established, or even later when the dividend was established, and there's some revisionist history, I think, that goes on, or creation of new history. And one of the things that I hear quite frequently from the public and read in letters to the editor is a grave concern about want the legislature to keep their hands off the earnings, or keep their hands off the permanent fund. And that probably stems in part from some perhaps over-enthusiastic campaigning by some legislators that say, I will protect the permanent fund. It's my understanding that the earnings of the permanent fund have been historically spent and are currently being spent. Am I correct in that the first few years that there was a permanent fund, all the earnings went into the general fund and were spent for state services?
Yeah. Through the chair, Senator Bundy, that's correct. As I just was talking about, the Constitution, when it was originally adopted, required all permanent fund income and earnings to go directly into the general fund. So in fiscal years 78 and 79 and part of 1980, all of the earnings of the permanent fund, and it was a much smaller fund in those days, they were deposited directly into the general fund and were spent with all other general fund spending. It was in 1981-82 that the legislature adopted the existing statute that says, please retain all earnings in an earnings reserve account, and that earnings reserve account is a part of the permanent fund. So starting in 82, we started retaining the earnings in the permanent fund subject to legislative appropriation, and that's the way it's been since then.
Senator Bundy, if I might just follow this a little bit further, I think it's been mentioned previously that about a third of the principal came from appropriations that the legislature made. And technically, I suppose, at least in my mind, that could be considered spending the earnings. We took it and put it back in the principal, but we at least appropriated the earnings. They didn't get there automatically. The legislature had to appropriate them.
Through the chair, Senator Bundy, correct. Again, the principal now is about $23 billion, and it's made up of the three pieces, two-thirds of which are the results of legislative appropriations, $7 billion for inflation proofing. And then the point I think you're making now is out of the earnings reserve, they've actually taken earnings that were available to spend on any action the legislature is authorized to take, and they chose to reinvest that, take it out of the spendable earnings reserve account, move it into the principal, and make it no longer eligible for spending. And that's happened consistently since the early 80s.
And yearly, on a regular basis, we appropriate tens of millions of dollars on the Hold Harmless, which, for those that are listening, are funds that we give people who receive welfare who might lose their welfare payment because their income went up when their dividend arrived.
Through the chair, Senator Bundy, approximately right now, out of the calculations of what's available to spend, there's about $35 million a year right now that goes to about five or six purposes, one of which is hold harmless. So there's about $35 million a year. $5 million covers the cost of operating the permanent fund dividend division. There's some money that goes to the Department of Corrections, and then there's money that goes to the Department of Health and Social Services. So for the last 5 years, it's averaged about $35 million a year that has been spent on non-dividend activities.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to get on the record that as we talk about the possibility of using some of the earnings of the permanent fund for state services, we're not treading on sacred ground. We, on a regular basis, spend at least $35 million, and in the past have spent. And while we may or may not choose to continue that in the future, I think it's important that we realize that it has occurred in the past.
Thanks, Senator Bundy. Other questions of finance members before we go to Senator Stedman?
I do have one more question. I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman, I appreciate your indulgence.
Oh, right.
It was interesting, Mr. Storr, your answer that it would be very hard for you to sell the public on the current system of calculating earnings and dividend because it's not compatible with acceptable accounting practices. Yet I hear very regularly, and I understand that there's been polls taken that at this point a clear majority of the public is resistant to the point of saying absolutely no to POMV because they of all the questions that have come up. I'm very concerned about putting something on the ballot that's predestined to fail. Do you have information, as the corporation gathered information, as to what, if it went out the vote tomorrow, what would the likely result be? And if that's not a result that would be best for Alaska, do you have plans that would realistically impact that result?
Through Chair, Senator Bundy, we do not yet have that information. We have had some focus groups. We'd like to be able to do some polling. I know that when people give us the opportunity to speak about the percentage of market value payout and they stand back and think about it, it's supported. I'll take you to the Conference of Alaskans, where this first straw poll was 55%, 75%, and then unanimously, because the more people heard about it, the more they realized it's inflation proofing, it's a management tool. I know that's a large hurdle. It's our goal is to, of course, get the legislature pass out through the legislature, and then spend even more time trying to educate the public on this important issue.
Mr. Chairman, if I might, and the reason of my concern is that I think in 1998-99 it was some sort of a POMV move, and I still hear from people on a fairly regular basis, what part of no don't you understand? And the logic of that event was clear to me, so I'm not sure that the logic of this current proposal will be clear to everyone.
I can, through the chair, I can appreciate that very much, Senator Bundy. I was not at the permanent fund. I was close to the permanent fund in that issue at that time, and I know that the it was a rather open-ended discussion advisory vote. I remember quite well that the amount that was to be drawn down or used was 5.85%, well in excess of inflation, and I knew that that everyone I knew had, there were many reasons why they were opposed to it, but the answer was no in the end. And I also recognize that it was a number of years before then, after that, where anyone was even willing to consider the permit fund. I would emphasize that our proposal is not a spending plan. It's a spending limit. And I'm hoping that the citizens of Alaska will appreciate that. And the goal is to memorialize inflation proofing in the Constitution, which ensures the long-term viability of the permanent fund. It's going to be a big hurdle, but hopefully we can get that message across. Bob, do you have something to add?
I think, Senator Bundy, Mr. Chair, I would just add that what we're hearing from the public is they're focused on the use of the earnings, not on the need to protect the permanent fund. And so I think it's going to be very clear that all the communications, whether it's from the Permanent Fund Corporation, from the legislature, from the administration, that when they're speaking on these issues and on the permanent fund, to be very clear on which piece of it you're speaking about and what are the intentions. Because the proposal from the trustees to amend the Constitution deals with changing the management of the fund and protecting it. There are other proposals that deal with the use of earnings, and at times they're pushed together. And we may be dealing with them pushed together, but whenever we communicate or when the committee takes action or when the permanent fund speaks on it, we have to talk about the separate pieces. Which part relates to the percentage of market value? Which part relates to the use of earnings? And I think if we can continue to clarify for the public what is it that we're talking about and what are we asking them to vote on, we may be able to make progress. But if we don't clearly identify the separate pieces, that's where I think the confusion is currently coming from. Is mixed messages.
Senator Dyson.
My understanding of this whole business and your testimony reminds me of flying an airplane or a boat in and out of the fog. Every once in a while I think I got it, and then something comes up. But let me see if I understand. You just helped clarify again. Under the POMV, it be a maximum of 5%. And if we're in a year or even a five-year period when the performance of the fund had been, let's say, 4%, then if this passed and was in law, constitution, then no more than 5% would be available for any kind of distribution, and help me here now, and if it had been a five-year average of 4% performance, would the spending, the limit be 4% or 5%?
Through the chair, Senator, at this point, it would be a 5% limit. In the Constitution, what's proposed would be a 5% limit. I think what you're referring to, there has been some discussions about what kind of guardrails could be placed on either the Constitution or the statutes, and we would just recommend you don't look at it even in five-year periods, but as the slide showed, try to look at least a 10-year period to do any sort of how has the permanent fund returns been.
Yeah, I understand that, but your answer to my question is the basis on which the critics say, see, the principle could be used because it would allow the spending down of the principle, in the illustration I use, spend 1% of the market value. And that's the wedge that critics are using that has a bit of truth in it. But it would seem to me that go ahead.
through the chair, Senator Dyson, that is one of the crux of the issues, and the answer is decision makers have the ability to determine whether the payout should be 5% or less. It could be, in your example, 4%, but you have the ability to determine what is in the best interest of the state, of the citizens of Alaska, et cetera. The example that I gave on the current formula, where there's a chance for no dividend at all, you don't have that option. So there's actually, I'd suggest there's greater flexibility under the POMV than there is the existing system. Now, I don't want to be shrill. It's a limited chance that there would be no dividend. So the key in my mind is the elected body would have the ability to determine whether it's the best interest to make a full 5% payout or 4 or less at any given year.
I may continue. Mm-hmm. And I might make the same argument, but it is still true that the critics could say, under present law, the legislators can't touch the principal. Under the example you and I just talked about, they could, and therein lies the jeopardy. So should we, for two reasons, one is to protect the principal, and or assuage the public's fears of this, should we have it that no more than 5% is available, or the 5-year average of what the performance is, so that the guarantee is that there'd be no withdrawal from the principal?
If I may, Mr. Chair. Yeah, well, the risk, if I may, for the chair, is if you tie it to performance, there are years where we earn 20%. So I wouldn't tie it to performance, but we have had discussions with some elected officials that would, by statute, create guidelines that would give the legislative body the insight to determine when that inflection point on whether one should use the all 5 or less than 5.
And just a couple more, if I may. But let's take the hypothetical that it has been a 4-year growth in the market value for 5 years, and we choose not to appropriate any money for any other purpose, or only take the 4%, and we use that for dividends or whatever. There would be no inflation proofing then. Well, and if inflation had been at 4% or more, then there would be no inflation proofing. So the fund wouldn't be automatically inflation proofing it, as it would be under the historical patterns of 8% growth and a 5% offtake, which gives you a 3% delta for the inflation proofing. So you'd have no inflation proofing, but the legislature could still get their hands on either 5% or, if they were more responsible, down to the 4, which they could spend on dividends or whatever.
Through the chair, Senator Dyson, I think what we have to compare is, if we're going to compare some worst case scenario markets under the POMV, I would then say your answer is correct. There would not have been inflation proofing in that particular time frame. But if there's no earnings, there wouldn't be any inflation proofing under the existing formula, but you would run out of money and be subject to no appropriations. So the difference between the two, you wouldn't inflation proof under either in that short 5-year period, and you either have an option for an appropriation under the POMV or the current structure where you would go to zero. And I think it's important for the public that it's when you're talking about the proposal of whether you should have the ability to spend money in the down markets, I think there's two important points for them to understand. One, part of why the current system we believe is broken and isn't prepared for down markets is we've commingled the earnings and the principal. We've taken $5 billion of earnings that should be available to cushion the payout in down years, and we pushed it into principal. So we've taken it off the table, and in essence, we've kind of broken the existing formula because there now is no cushion for near-term down markets. So I think it's important for the public to know that if we hadn't swept the earnings into principal, there'd be $5 billion in the earnings reserve today for down markets, and you could spend that without hitting principal. Under POMV, we're immediately saying in the good years, if you earn 20%, or when the, as we saw on the slide, the earnings reserve gets to $3 or $4 billion, the risk under the current formulas, we believe, is much bigger, that the risk of spending a little bit of the principal in the down markets is far outweighed by when the earnings reserve grows to $3 billion in a short-term bull market, say 2000, and the legislature has a short-term need, and so they appropriate a lot more than 5% of the fund, you're at risk of overspending. So when the public is asked, would you like the current system where you can't touch principal compared to POMV, where you might be allowed to spend down into the corpus of the fund in a short-term down market, but you're not going to be able to overspend in the good years, it's a trade-off. It's where are you getting the most protection, and the trustees believe you're protecting more of the fund for a longer period by a 5% spending limit than protecting principal that in some years is only 80% of the fund. You could appropriate 20%.
Just quickly, and under POMV, there is no earning reserve account, right?
As proposed, there would not be.
Right. Thank you. Thank you for the latitude. You bet. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just had you touched on it earlier, Mr. Starr, about the management tool that the POMV is. If it's such a good management tool, why hasn't it been seriously or aggressively proposed before? And wait until this period of time when we're in such a financial crisis that it makes the public very wary of what's going on. And that's where the big difficulty is trying to sell them at this time where everything does look like the appetite is there to spend.
Through the chair, Senator Olson, great question. And we found that at least back to 1994, Commissioner Hume alone, who was a trustee, was proposing a POMV payout. My time back at the fund as executive director, I worked there in the 80s as an investment officer. It started in February 2000, and it was shortly after that at a retreat there was a conclusion by the board that they would pose a constitutional amendment change then. So it was identified well before the current fiscal problems, but it's taken really 4 years to elevate the discussion to the point where we are today. I know Bob and I have been around since the beginning of those discussions, and we view negative comments as a positive because at least people are paying attention right now. But the answer, it was addressed, but it's become more and more important.
Last question, Mr. Chairman, and that is, are there any funds out there that have used the POMV management tool that have had where it's had a negative effect, and people that made that decision have regretted the decision to go to the POMV?
The Chair, Senator Olson, I don't know about regret. First off, we find endowment funds, there's a study that says 85% of the participants in Nakubo, National Association of College and University Business Offices. 85% use some variant of the percentage of market value payout. I have some friends that are close to the endowment industry, and what they regret is not the POMV. What they regret is they got caught up in overspending. And the answer is yes. I know a former colleague of mine in the Department of Revenue is working for a foundation that had to cut spending dramatically and lay off. They had 42 employees. They had to lay off 7. I know of at least one university that got caught up in the great years and started a capital project. You can't stop buildings in the middle of the project. So it's, the issue is not POMV. The issue is they created an unsustainable percentage of payout.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Visiting senators. Senator Stedman.
Just happen to be sitting here, right? It's nice and handy. If I could back up a little bit, some of the terminology on occasions may concern some people, you know, outside of the building here. And when you talk about modernization, I'm under the impression that a percent of market value has been used by some endowments and so on and so forth for a substantial amount of years. And could you give me a rough estimate of that? When that started to come
Chair,
in?
Chair, Senator Stedman, I think the first reference we found was the Ford Foundation in 1968. I think you saw less of this in the 70s because all funds were invested more conservatively, and public funds were substantially invested in fixed income, much as the manner of the permanent fund. So we find that in the 80s, you see more and more of the conversion to the percentage of market value payout. And some universities have some very complex formulas that go around it, but the first point we found is 1968, right? Ford Foundation, I think that's correct.
So this isn't, when we use the word modern, you know, I think we need to be, I guess we need to put it in perspective of, we're not taking our Alaska Permanent Fund and putting it out on the leading edge of portfolio theory. And aren't we not the way we're structured now, even with the adoption of PMV, substantially behind your wise, like an endowment like Harvard, which happens to be one of the leaders?
Yes, through the Chair, Senator Stedman. The permanent fund is still one of the more conservative managed public funds in the country. Our peers in the public arena are retirement systems, and they don't use a POMV because their liability is the retirees and what meeting that obligation. Even as applies to public funds, we are more conservatively structured, and unlike other public funds, we also have a statutory list which states what we may or may not invest in with limitations, and that doesn't exist at most public funds as well. If you go into the endowment and foundation portion of the plan sponsor industry, you'll find that they are considerably more aggressive than the permanent fund or even the retirement systems here with the state. I got a call just the other day for somebody that's looking to fill a position, and it's a major university, and 23% of that fund is invested in very sophisticated absolute return private equity allocations. We have about 57-58% invested in the U.S. and international equity market, publicly traded, and that's still slightly on the conservative side. this was an endowment fund, it'd be probably 70% or more. So we are, you are absolutely correct. We're not inventing anything new, and we are still and will be more conservatively structured than most funds.
So we haven't adopting, if we do go ahead and adopt POMV, we're going to be nowhere near the leading edge. We'll be back in the middle of the pack or maybe a little bit further back.
Chair, you could say we're catching up.
Okay. And then is there other public entities in the state that use this concept?
Through Chair Senator Stedman, virtually all that I can think of, University of Alaska, Fairbanks, that foundation uses it. The City of Anchorage uses a percentage of market value payout for a fund that they developed that from the sale of their telephone utility. I've been an advisor on the Exxon Valdez Oil Spill Council for years, and they use a percentage of market value payout methodology as well. And I believe, but I could be wrong on this, but I know that the City of Valdez or Port of Valdez has created a permit fund, and I'm under the impression that they also use a percentage of market value payout. And Sitka, I believe, also uses a percentage of market value payout.
Okay, so it's nothing new in the state either. If we can just switch gears just a little bit and jump back to a topic right before I had the floor. There was some discussion of a potential dipping into principal if we had 2 or 3 or 4 years of declining markets under a percent of market value. Payout of 5% regardless of where the 5% went. But under the current status, what is the principal portion of the permanent fund? The market value is roughly $28 billion.
Through the Chair, Senator Sedman, that's absolutely correct. And the principal, through as I defined it, contributions, inflation proofing, and special appropriations is about $23.1 billion as of the end of February.
So if we just, I know some people choose bodies sometimes of dropping a lot of zeros, but if, just because I think that concept is more important than getting to the exact numerics, but roughly we have a $23 billion principal and a $28 billion market value. And if we adopt percent of market value, then the principal classification would jump from 23 to 28 billion, correct?
Correct. Under the, through the chair, percentage of market value, what would be available would probably be about 1.3 billion plus or minus, maybe 1.1350, mm-hmm. something like that. As it currently stands, that entire slightly less than $5 billion would be available for appropriation if the legislature deemed the need.
Right. I guess the point of that question is because you really get into a disproportionate comparison when you talk about getting involved or dipping into the principal, when on one hand you count under the proposed plan, percent of market value, you count the market value on a particular given day, June 30th, a five-year average, mm-hmm. like what we're talking about. Then on the other policy parameters, you have some number substantially below that. And how long would it take if we were under a percent of market value, if we had normal bear markets, to dip into what we classify as the principal today, not the principal that would be reclassified under a percent of market value?
Well, through the chair, I'm not sure the definition normal bear market. I'm not sure it's an oxymoron, but it depends on the nature of the bear market. We had an $8 billion cushion in roughly eight, maybe more, in that March of 2000, shortly after I arrived, and we were able to inflation-proof the fund and pay out three substantial dividends during that period. The question I asked myself, and I'll get back to your answer in a second, but the question I asked myself is, what happened, what would have happened if all of those profits would have been appropriated then, and not that it would happen, but some people spoke to it, and then you would have had a fund that probably didn't pay anything for 3 or 4 years. I'm not so sure that's in anybody's best interest. Under the current environment, what's a normal bear market? As long as we've got this cushion, then you've got a couple years. It depends on the magnitude of the loss. I apologize for not being specific, but there's so many permutations that can occur.
Would you not agree that it would take a longer time to dip into the principal using the current calculation if we spent 5% per year than the definition of dipping into the principal under a PUMV?
I would agree with that through the chair, Senator Sandman. I would agree with that, and there might be another thing that occurs as well. It did not happen before, but it's human behavior. If you had PUMV, I think you would find boards more inclined to stay the course, which is so critically important when you're investing in the equity market. In fact, we experienced, because of that deficit discipline, the Permanent Fund Board did capture the rise in the equity market. So the unknown, as long as you're speculating, the unknown is future boards, future administrators in a ever descending market, would their behavior alter and disinvest from the equities at the bottom of a period and go into more conservative bonds? That's a risk as well.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Stedman.
Other questions from visiting senators? Senator Guest.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just actually have one question. Why the Constitution and not statute?
Through the chair, Senator Guest, the Constitution is the whole intent. It was to the original intent of the Permanent Fund Board, which was to move inflation proofing from statute and currently it's in statute after the dividend, to the stronger language, which is memorialize inflation proofing in the Constitution. Statutes can be changed. And so that strengthens, in a board's opinion, that strengthens the concept of inflation proofing by putting it in the Constitution.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, and I would just add a second part. You also can't get the second part of the fix in statute, which is if we have near-term down markets and we've locked up all those excess earnings, they would not be available if you tried to do the spending limit in the statutes and we had near-term down markets, then you would have what's one of the weaknesses with the current system, which is you could take your payout to little or no payout. And the only way to fix that is by the Constitution, where you get rid of the earnings reserve in principle and make it into one fund. By statute, you can put a spending limit in. It's not as secure as a constitutional spending limit, but you do not get the benefit of help in near-term down markets. You can't get that by statute. That can only be through the constitutional amendment.
Yeah, so follow-up question then. Then the earnings is always available for the legislature to appropriate. So I guess I understood the first point, but don't understand the second point of locking up the earnings. Those earnings may be there in down markets, but what it doesn't do is ensure that we don't go into the principal, which would be against the current Constitution.
through the chair, Senator, I guess that's what it does. It assures that as we faced in 2000, where the earnings reserve almost went to zero, and it went to zero because we had paid a dividend the year before, it went down because the stock market had gone down, and it went down because the legislature in 99 swept $250 million out of it. So we drove that account to a very small number. And if the down market would have extended three more months, you would have gone to zero and had no payout because the earnings reserve would have went empty. Under the POMV, you still have the option in those down markets to make an appropriation. And if the goal is to never allow that, to maintain the current concept of principle, then I think that's what you're speaking to, is then you could do that statutorily. But if you're trying to protect more of the fund when the principal only makes up 80% of the permanent fund and there's 20% available for appropriation, you can achieve that through statute if everybody agrees. But the downside risk is still there of going to little or no payout.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Questions from visiting senators? Back to the table. Senator Bundy.
Thank you. Just to clarify on item three of your overview, Mr. Bartholomew, that would be simply putting into the Constitution what is current practice based on statute.
That's correct. The third item, which would delete the part where all income goes into the general fund, would be deleted, and all income would remain in the permanent fund by Constitution, which is currently being accomplished by a statute.
Senator Bundy, I hasten to follow, though, that then it remains in the permanent fund, but if all this works, then up to 5% would be available for appropriation.
That's correct.
Other questions on SGR 18? Senator Wagoner.
In a way, this is kind of an aside, but you mentioned it earlier, and I just wanted to clarify it because I've had a lot of constituents ask. You said if the legislature passes the POMV and it goes out for a vote, you would then advertise and promote it to the public. And I've heard discussion about this. Where's the funds coming from that you plan to use to promote the vote on the POMV?
Bob, you want to take this?
To the chair, Senator Wagner, at this point there's a request for both the FY04 and FY05 budgets that's sitting in front of the Senate Finance Committees. So we've asked for funding to be provided from the earnings of the permanent fund for the education and advocacy of POMV. So if those measures weren't successful, then we would not be going out and doing a statewide, you know, campaign where we're using radio and TV to try to educate people. We would continue to do what we've done historically, which is go to places where we're invited to speak or look for opportunities to speak. So the board asked us to bring that to the legislature, and if they agreed, that as the board does, that there is a big void of education on the fund that's needed, they recommend that money be appropriated for it, but they realize that that's a decision that still has to be made.
So it's going to be a request to the legislature to fund it out of fund earnings.
That's correct.
That's what I want. Thank you.
Any other questions?
Senator Bundy? Well, just speculation. The opposition to the POMV idea seems to be coalescing around a group that calls itself Just Say No. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the public policy issues wouldn't fall in your regime. They say Just Say No, tax somebody else or cut somebody else's state spending. And as I interpret it, but to balance the budget. And their big thing is concerned about using any of the earnings at all for state spending. Well, I think I've already indicated we already use millions and in the past have used billions for various public policy initiatives. Do you have an idea how you can address the Just Say No group who seem to want to end their argument and begin their argument with just no?
Through the chair, Senator Bundy, we asked to speak to the Just Say No group. And they didn't say no. They didn't say anything. So so we would love the opportunity to speak to them and be held accountable to them, because I think they asked some important questions as well, and we would invite that. And look forward to the opportunity.
I'm sorry, Bob. I didn't hear you asked to speak before them, and their reply was?
They did not say just say no. They haven't said anything.
Oh, no, they haven't replied. Okay.
So we're still waiting. Okay. We would like that opportunity.
I didn't hear that.
Thank you.
Senator French.
Thank you. Mr. Storr, you know from our earlier conversations on this subject that I have for some time been concerned about the long-term effects of inflation and the possibility that we're entering a new financial era in which we may see a return to the hyperinflationary times of the early 70s. I think if you had asked the best and brightest financial minds 4 years ago whether we could possibly go from a $500 billion projected budget surplus to a $500 billion projected budget deficit, I think they would have said, well, that's, well, there's no way that can't, we couldn't possibly do that. No one would let us do that. And so I'm concerned about, I guess, the unforeseen.
Mm-hmm.
The just sitting here now and listening to the presentation, I made a little asterisk in SJR 18 on page 2 in line 3 and said, you know, what if we inserted some clause that said something like this? Right when you get to the words 5%, if you said either the difference between the rate of return and the rate of inflation or 5% of the average of the market values, et cetera, whichever is less, that would give you some, in good years, when the market gave you 10% and inflation was 3 and you returned 7, you'd just take the 5 out. That would give you that upside protection. But in bad years, when the market gives you 5% and inflation runs 6, it would close off the draw from the fund. Mm-hmm. And I'm just curious whether the board has thought about any possibility of some kind of closing off mechanism that would slow down the draw and not leave it up to us. Because my concern is, as I've also mentioned, is that by giving us the authority to take 5% a year and by selling this to the public as a stable payout, eventually you come to the place where you can't take less than 5%.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm wondering if there's some way to, if you guys have thought about language that would build in at sideboards for that long and unforeseen period of a bad market.
To the chair, Senator French, I know this is an important subject, and hopefully we won't. There's been two extremes that occurred in the 20th century. One is financial markets. One was the Depression, and then the other was the hyperinflation of the 70s, and I hope we don't see either one of them. The problem with hyperinflation, you've got a problem under the current system, or POMV. I believe that one very strongly, so it becomes a magnitude issue, in which or which is more superior methodology. We've worked with a number of, we discussed with a number of elected officials that sort of conceptual information or insight, but we've been speaking more in terms of statutory insight and not constitutional insight. I would caution, if you get too many competing formulas in the language, you could come up with a problem, and so I would suggest that simplicity in the Constitution and then more insight in statutes would be my recommendation. I don't know, Bob, if you've got anything to add on that or not. It's an important issue.
No, I think it's
it's a big policy decision, which, where to place that, that limitation. And the only thing I think I would add is, whatever we do, whether it's in the Constitution or the statute, you can't do it on a year-to-year basis. It's too volatile. So as long as you look at it over some long time frame and assure the real value over time, then I think you have a policy decision of where to place it. But we know year-to-year you can go from a 20% gain to a 5% loss. So I just think we definitely would recommend against any year-to-year analysis and stretch it over time. And then it's kind of a legislative decision as to where's the best place to place that public policy limitation in the Constitution or the statute.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Other questions? Comments? Well, thank you, Mr. Storr, Mr. Bartholomew. Thank you for being with us today and presenting SJR 18. We'll set it aside. And we'll start tomorrow at 9 a.m. to talk about Senate Joint Resolution 19. Senator Lincoln is out of town, but that will be presented by her staff with some assistance from other staff. Then we'll go to Senator Elton with SJR 32. For the committee, I have a request to waive Senate Bill 327 having to do with rollerblades. It was expected to pick up a fiscal note. It did not. So if the committee would please look at that and approve, or let me know if you don't want to waive it, why we wouldn't. And with that, is there anything else to come before the committee before we adjourn for the day? Seeing none, we're adjourned until 9 a.m. tomorrow morning.